I'd like to start by sharing with you a story. Many of you may know Rabbi Radansky from Amerenek. Rabbi Radansky has an older brother, Dr. Max Radansky, who's a dear friend of mine and a neurologist in Huntington. Some years ago, Dr. Radansky shared with me a truly wonderful story that has stuck with me to this very day. The story begins about 8 years ago on Rosh Hashanah. A new woman came into the synagogue in Huntington for the very first time. Mrs. Radansky, doing what she would normally do in such a situation, walked over to introduce herself to this new person. The woman explained that unfortunately she wasn't really there for good reasons. Her father, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Gordon, was suffering from advanced ALS, commonly referred to as Lou Gehrig's disease. As some of you may know, Lou Gehrig's disease is a degenerative neurological condition which ultimately results in respiratory failure and is obviously terminal. Dr. Gordon at this point was at an advanced stage of the disease and was unable to leave his home to attend synagogue on Rosh Hashanah. His daughter, who lived in Maryland, had come up to Huntington to be with her father during what everybody expected to be one of the final months of his life. As the Radanskys were walking home from synagogue after the Rosh Hashanah morning service, they began talking. Dr. Radansky knew of Dr. Gordon. They were physicians in town for many years together. Didn't really have what they would call a friendship, but acquaintances nonetheless. Dr. Radansky turned to his son Isaac, who was about 14 years old at the time, and suggested to him that perhaps they should walk over to Dr. Gordon's house that afternoon to blow shofar for him. Isaac Radansky was quite skilled at blowing shofar. They debated back and forth. It was a particularly hot Rosh Hashanah afternoon. As many of us know, the davening services in the morning were quite long, and it was a 2-mile walk to go and visit the Gordons. On top of that, they didn't really know him too well and weren't quite sure how they would be received just showing up in the middle of the afternoon with a suggestion to blow shofar. After a bit of debate back and forth, they finally decided they weren't going to let this opportunity pass them by, and they would go, in fact, make the effort and walk over to Dr. Gordon's home. Excuse me, I got a little bit of a cold, so I apologize if I cough a little bit. So, when they reached the Gordon's home, they were pleasantly surprised as they were welcomed with a warm embrace into the home. Dr. Gordon was truly moved that these people, who he had barely known, one of whom was a 14-year-old kid, had made the effort to walk over to his home, take time out of their Rosh Hashanah afternoon to blow shofar for him. As Isaac stood there blowing shofar, the tears began to well up in Dr. Gordon's eyes, and it truly was a memorable experience for all who were there. At that time, the Radanskys had the opportunity to meet for the very first time members of Dr. Gordon's extended family, including his wife. If the story would end there, it would be a beautiful story. But, as you may suspect, it continues. Approximately 6 weeks later, Dr. Radansky was in his office. His partner, Jacques, was covering the hospital that day, and Dr. Radansky was seeing patients in the office. At about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, he received a call from the hospital from Jacques, saying that Jacques had to go to an appointment with Dr. Radansky mind covering the hospital. He said it was a particularly quiet day in the hospital, and he didn't expect that there would be any reasons that Dr. Radansky would have to come to the hospital. Of course, Dr. Radansky agreed, and they hung up the phone. Perhaps 5-10 minutes after they hung up the phone, of course, a call comes from the hospital. There's an acute emergency. Somebody has suffered a major stroke, and Dr. Radansky has to rush to the hospital. As he rushes into the ER, he notices out of the corner of his eye, there's a woman there who he recognizes somewhat but can't quite place her. Obviously not having time to figure out who she was and try to place her, he rushed off to take care of the patient that he was there to see. He was able to thank God, take care of the patient, and began writing up his report of what had happened. As he was writing up the report, the woman who he had noticed as he came into the ER came over to him. She said, "Dr. Radansky, you may not remember me, but I'm Dr. Gordon's wife. You and your son came to blow shofar in my home this past Rosh Hashanah." Obviously, Dr. Radansky quickly made the association and inquired as to how she was, and equally importantly, how's her husband. Pointing over to the other side of the emergency room, she said to Dr. Adansky, "Unfortunately, my husband's not really doing very well. His breathing is beginning to fail, and the doctors are expecting that these are the final moments of his life." Dr. Adansky glanced over to the side of the ER where she had pointed and saw that they had drawn the curtain closed, signifying that the end was really near. At that moment, Dr. Gordon's daughter, the same one who had been in the synagogue, came rushing into the ER for obvious reasons. Mrs. Gordon and her daughter continued conversing with Dr. Adansky and explaining to him that there was a decision that needed to be made. Dr. Gordon's respiratory system was clearly failing. The decision needed to be made whether to put him on a respirator. Some of the doctors were advising that it was a hopeless endeavor. He had advanced ALS, and that once put on a respirator, they'd never get him off, and he was already unconscious. They asked Dr. Adansky what they should do. Dr. Adansky asked, "Well, did you ever discuss with him what he would want in such a situation?" They said, "No, we never spoke about it." "Did he ever give you any indication that he would not want to be resuscitated and put on a respirator?" They said, "No, we never spoke about it." Assessing the facts, Dr. Adansky advised that yes, it was fairly likely, given his condition, that the reason that his respiratory system was failing was because of the ALS, but it wasn't definitive. Therefore, he advised that they should put him on the respirator. Following Dr. Adansky's advice, Mrs. Gordon advised the attending physicians that they should indeed put her husband on a respirator. Over the following few days, Dr. Gordon gradually regained consciousness and ultimately regained strength, to the point that he was able to once again leave the hospital. A few days later, Dr. Adansky went to visit Dr. Gordon in the nursing home where he was now living. Dr. Gordon was overjoyed to see Dr. Adansky, obviously had been informed by that point from his family what had taken place. He explained to Dr. Adansky that he knew the end was near for him, but he wasn't ready to die yet. He thanked Dr. Adansky for giving him a new lease on life. Dr. Gordon lived another three months, ultimately succumbed to an infection, not to the ALS, and during that interim 3 months was able to attend the celebration of one of his grandchildren's weddings. On that hot, sunny Rosh Hashanah day, Isaac Radansky and Dr. Adansky had every excuse to just spend some time that afternoon relaxing in their home. But they decided instead to seize an opportunity that presented itself to do a kind act for their fellow Jew. Unbeknownst to them at the time, that one simple act set in motion a chain of events with the guidance of God that ultimately gave a dying man 3 more months to live and the opportunity to celebrate his grandchild's wedding. As we all know, next week is Rosh Hashanah. When Rosh Hashanah comes, we all appropriately approach God with a litany of blessings that we're asking for the upcoming year. Good health, good fortune, and peace are amongst those very important things that we're asking for. Let us stop for a moment and imagine that we were on the other side of the table, so to speak. We were in God's shoes. We've all been in positions when somebody comes to ask us for something. Maybe an employee coming to ask for a day off, a charitable organization coming to ask for a donation, or a child coming to ask for a $20 bill. What is one of the first questions we ask ourselves when faced with a request such as this? What is the person going to do with the thing they're asking for? What's their objective? As we approach God on Rosh Hashanah, we need to ask ourselves the very same question. We're asking God for many blessings, but what are we planning on doing with them? If we're asking God for good health, what do we plan on doing with the peace and tranquility that affords us? If we're asking God for good fortune, what do we plan on doing with it? The 13th century rabbinic scholar Rabbeinu Yonah drove this point home with great clarity when he compared our approach to God to a date in front of a human judge. As we all know, as a court date approaches, the litigants work meticulously to prepare their arguments. They examine the situation from every possible angle, hoping to come up with whatever angle they can to ultimately tip the judgment in their favor. Our approach to God on Rosh Hashanah deserves no less a meticulous preparation. I would like to suggest what I believe to be one of the most powerful arguments that we can make as we approach God on Rosh Hashanah. And that is to say to God, yes, I understand that I'm asking for a long list of very important blessings, and they are very important. But I'm not only asking for these blessings for myself. I'm asking for these blessings in order to have the opportunity to be the conduit to share these blessings with those around me. I am committing myself in the upcoming year to live a life that is suffused with the attitude of concern and to create for myself a lifestyle of kindness. A lifestyle of kindness. What is that? I'm familiar with the word lifestyle and I'm familiar with the word kindness. But what's a lifestyle of kindness? The Torah in Sefer Bereishis in the book of Genesis recounts the stories and the events that surround Abimelech, the king of Gerar, coming to make a peace treaty with Abraham. The Torah says, "Vayhi ba'esahi, vayomer Abimelech u'pichol tzar tzvao." It was at that time that Abimelech and his general Pichol said, El Avraham Lemar said to Abraham, "Elokim imcha b'kol asher ata oseh." God is with you in all that you do. It was as a result of the fact that Abimelech recognized that Abraham was a man of God that he decided that this was a person I want to formulate a peace treaty with. The Medrash explores what was it that Abimelech saw in Abraham that led him to the conclusion that this was a man of God. The Medrash explains, it is well known that Abraham was a person who always was looking for opportunities to help others. He was particularly skilled in the area of hospitality, of having guests. Abraham's tent was open in all four directions so that guests and travelers coming from any direction would feel comfortable coming in. Abraham's tent was situated on the road from Sodom. Unfortunately, after the destruction of the city of Sodom, Abraham noticed that there weren't as many travelers coming by. He wasn't having the same number of opportunities to open his home to those who were coming by. Seeing the situation, Abraham picked up his tent and moved it to a location where there was more traffic. Seeing this act from Abraham led Abimelech to the conclusion that this is a man of God. Abraham was not content with the opportunities to help others that presented themselves to him, but rather he sought out and searched for additional opportunities where perhaps others didn't see them. This is what defines a lifestyle of kindness. It is a situation where we don't settle for those opportunities to help others that present themselves to us, no matter if we reply in the affirmative to them, but rather we seek out those opportunities, we search for those opportunities, we identify those opportunities in places where perhaps the other people don't see them. This, I believe, is the argument that can carry a tremendous weight for us as we approach Rosh Hashanah. We can say to God, yes, I am asking for blessings. I'm asking for talents, I'm asking for skills, I'm asking for a good situation. But I'm asking for those in order that I can use those to create this lifestyle of kindness, to use them to seek out opportunities to make life a little bit more enjoyable and a little bit brighter for those around me. How do we develop this lifestyle of kindness? I would like to suggest a 5-step plan. Try to move through the steps quickly, but each one is important in its own right. Step number one, the pre-Rosh Hashanah self-analysis. What is the pre-Rosh Hashanah self-analysis? The pre-Rosh Hashanah self-analysis is to ask ourselves some of the following questions. What do I enjoy? What am I good at? Each of us has unique things that we enjoy and that we're good at. Once we are able to identify those, then we need to ask ourselves the following follow-up question. How can I use those things that I enjoy and those things that I'm good at to help someone else? Perhaps I'm a talented artist. I can create a picture and deliver it to someone who's ill. Perhaps I'm good with numbers. I can volunteer to help a charity analyze its financial situation. Perhaps I am really good at shopping. I happen to not be that person, but I know some people who are. If I'm really good at shopping and I enjoy it, I can volunteer to help a single parent trying to manage a loan or a senior citizen who has a hard time getting out get those things that they need. Rav Yerocham Levavitz encapsulated this idea very clearly when he said, "It is unfortunate if I don't recognize my shortcomings, but it is truly tragic if I don't recognize my abilities. Because once I recognize my abilities, then I understand what I can do with them." Step number one, the pre-Rosh Hashanah self-analysis. What do I do? What do I enjoy? And how can I use that to help someone else? Step number two, I'd like to illustrate with a story. The story comes from Rabbi Pesach Kron, the author of the Proper Maggid series on inspirational true stories. The story begins as Mr. Josh Blonstein, tough name, is driving through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, from his home in Brooklyn to his office in Manhattan. Driving through the tunnel, Josh remembers there was a very important phone call that he forgot to make. Seeing as this is the pre-cell phone era, he needs to find a payphone. Some of you may remember what a payphone is. Those things on the side of the road, you pick it up, it's black, you know. So, as he comes out of the Battery Tunnel, he sees a payphone on the side of the road and pulls off to make the call. He's about to pick up the phone. He notices next to the phone that this is also the pre-PDA days. So there's a black planner, calendar, paper, appointments in it. His first inclination is, "I'm very busy. Let me leave it here. Hopefully somebody will come back and find it." But remembering that he happens to be the person who's going to be reading the Torah the following morning in synagogue, it was Friday afternoon, and that week's Torah portion, that week's parsha was Parshas Ki Teitzei, which includes in it not only the commandment to return a lost object, but also the commandment not to turn one's eyes away from that lost object if he comes across it. Realizing that this might be somewhat of a message, he decides, okay, let me take the planner. He makes his phone call, takes the planner under his arm, off to work he goes. Sits down at his desk, flips to that day's date, August 19th, hoping to find an appointment for that day with a phone number. No such luck. Flips through a couple more pages, looking for some sort of identification. No luck. Okay, puts it on the side, finishes his day's work. Friday afternoon, heads home, shows it to his wife. She opens it up, flips through the pages, trying to find some identification, no luck. Okay, Shabbos comes, beautiful Shabbos. After Shabbos, Mrs. Blonstein again picks up the book, starts to flip through it again, trying to find who the owner might be. This time she notices the inside of the back cover, a phone number under the listing Mom. Now we're in business. Florida phone number, she calls the number, a nice woman answers the phone. She explains that her husband found a planner in Manhattan, a little bit about it. The woman, and she explains that they are religious Jews, and there's a mitzvah to return a lost object. The woman on the other line says, "Well, it sounds like that very well may be my daughter. She lives in Manhattan. Let me give you her name and number." Great. They speak, chat for a few more minutes, and hang up the phone. Mrs. Blonstein calls the daughter, and sure enough, thanks her profusely. "I've lost my planner. I'll be there tomorrow to pick it up." Young woman comes Sunday morning, picks up the planner, thanks them, "I was lost without it. Thank you so much." Again, had this been the end of the story, it would be a very nice story about doing something nice for somebody else. But, as you may guess, the story continues. The following Friday, the same young woman shows up at the Blonstein home. This time, however, she comes bearing gifts and a card. She explains to the Blonsteins that about 5 years ago, she had made the decision to begin living a more religiously committed Jewish life. Her mother did not support this decision. Their relationship had become quite strained. However, receiving this call from the Blonsteins had made her mother feel overwhelmed. She called her daughter and said, "If these are the type of people that you're trying to be like, now I understand where you're coming from." She explained to the Blonsteins that her mother and her had spoken more frequently and with more warmth over the course of the past week than they had done in years. A simple, small act of kindness salvaged a relationship between a mother and daughter which had been strained for years. Step number two, recognizing that no act of kindness is too small. Step number one, pre-Rosh Hashanah self-analysis. Step number two, internalizing and understanding that no act of kindness is too small. Step number three was best surmised by a quote that I saw in a recent interview with a successful Disney executive. You might be a little bit surprised to hear that, and so was I. This executive explained that once she was walking through a flea market and noticed an engraving on the wall which changed her life. The engraving said, "What would you do if you knew you could not fail?" The truth is, this very same idea was taught to us in the Torah many years before this Disney executive happened across this inscription. In Sefer Shmos, the Torah describes the events surrounding Moshe's birth. At that time, it was a particularly bleak moment in Jewish history. The Jews were enslaved in Egypt, in Mitzrayim, and Paro had decreed that every Jewish boy who was born should be thrown into the Nile River. The Torah recounts what happened when Yocheved, Moshe's mother, gave birth to Moshe. The pasuk says, "Vatara isha, vateled ben, vatera oso kitovu, vatitzbeneu shloshi yarachim." The woman conceived, she gave birth to a son, she saw that he was good, and she hid him. The Ramban is struck by the peculiar nature of this pasuk, of this verse. The verse seems to link Yocheved, Moshe's mother's willingness to hide him, to the fact that she saw that he was good. The Ramban wonders, any mother in that situation where the choices were between hiding her son, newly born son, and having him face certain death, would obviously hide her son. What is the linkage between the fact she saw that he was good and her decision to hide him? The Ramban goes on to explain that when Moshe was born, there was a special aura about him, a special glow of holiness, shall we say. Yocheved's mother, upon seeing this glow, was convinced that her son would merit special divine protection. Armed with this confidence that she would succeed, Yocheved was able to tap into her inner strength and ability to think creatively and follow through on her ideas. The heartfelt belief that she could succeed allowed her to find an inner strength and an inner creativity to come up with an approach that she may not have otherwise thought of. This is step number three, believing that we can succeed. Step number one, the pre-Rosh Hashanah self-analysis. Step number two, no act of kindness is too small. Step number three, believing that we can succeed in making a difference through our acts of kindness. Step number four, I'd like to once again return to a different story which involves Moshe Rabbeinu. Involves Moshe. This time it has to do with Moshe's return to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, to lead the Jews out of slavery. As Moshe's coming back to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, Hashem tells Aaron, his older brother, that Moshe's coming back to lead the Jews to freedom. Aaron, realizing that Moshe might feel a bit uncomfortable about the situation because he has been granted the leadership position ahead of his older brother, makes the decision to go out into the wilderness and greet Moshe and welcome him back. The Medrash recounts that had Aaron realized that the Torah was going to record for all eternity his act of going out to greet Moshe, rather than going out himself, he would have assembled an entire orchestra of instruments and given him a grand greeting. The question is somewhat obvious. If the right thing to do was to greet him with instruments, so why was that to be dependent upon whether Aaron realized it was going to be recorded or not? The answer, I believe, is that when we recognize that our actions are important, that they are recorded, that they're remembered, that gives us an extra strength not to suffice with the minimum effort, but really to look for opportunities to excel. The same holds true with our acts of kindness. Step number 4 is to realize that each act of care and genuine concern that we perform for another person is not only recognized, but beloved by God. Even if no one else in the entire world recognizes it, that act is recorded forever. If we really appreciate that fact, we will be able to find an extra dose of strength to follow through on what we'd like to do. The last step, step number 5. This, arguably, is the most important step. This is really where we train ourselves for a lifestyle of kindness. Pirkei Avos, Ethics of Our Father, when discussing kindness, says the following words: Hakol lefi rov hamaisa. Kindness is assessed based on the abundance of deeds. The Rambam, Maimonides, is a bit troubled by the choice of language here. Why does the Pirkei Avos say that kindness is assessed based on the abundance of deeds rather than based on the magnitude of deeds? Godel hamaisa, the magnitude, the impact, how big the deed is. The Rambam explains that I can summon my inner strength and inner care and concern for a person to perform a singular, large act of kindness, a dramatic thing, something that really makes a splash. But that commitment will quickly dissipate once that event is over. If I really want to develop within myself a lasting character trait of genuine concern and care for others, the way to do that is through consistency. Consistent small acts, day to day, week to week. That is how I train myself and accustom myself to being a person who lives a life of kindness. Let's summarize. I want to create for myself in the upcoming year a lifestyle of kindness. An approach to life where I don't suffice with those opportunities that present themselves to me, but I seek them out. I search for new ones. How do I do that? First, I have to assess my talents and how I can use them. Second, I have to recognize that no deed is too small. Third, I have to believe that I can succeed. Four, I have to recognize that each deed is remembered. And five, I have to be consistent. I have to do it continuously. I'd like to make one final point before concluding with a story. As we embark on this lifestyle of kindness, which we've been discussing tonight, we will obviously bring great joy to those around us. But that's not all that we'll accomplish. The Medrash says, Yoser shebal habayis osa im ani, ha'ani osa im bal habayis. More than a benefactor does for the poor person who receives his kindness or charity, the poor person does for the benefactor. The simple meaning of these words is that while the poor person, the recipient of the kindness, is receiving a benefit in this world, something which brings them enjoyment and alleviates their situation, the benefactor, the provider of this kindness, is receiving a much greater reward, a reward from God, a spiritual reward, a permanent reward. But there's an additional meaning, and that is very much in this physical world. And that is that human beings are constructed in such a way that we derive a tremendous sense of joy and satisfaction ourselves by helping those around us. By embarking on this lifestyle of kindness, we will not only be improving the lives of those around us, but we will dramatically improve our own sense of joy, satisfaction, and accomplishment. I'd like to conclude with a story. The story was shared with me by Rabbi David Orlovsky. Originally from Long Island, Rabbi David Orlovsky currently lives in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, where he's a popular lecturer and teacher. A number of years ago, a mother living in Jerusalem came to Rabbi Orlovsky. She said, "Rabbi, I want to change the world." "That's beautiful," said Rabbi Orlovsky. "But you're busy with your children. That's an especially wonderful thing. The amount of time and effort you're putting into them is remarkable." She said, "Rabbi, you didn't hear me. I want to change the world." Not to be dissuaded, Rabbi Orlovsky said, "Yes, but a warm, cohesive Jewish family, that's the foundation of the Jewish people." "Rabbi, I want to do something that changed the world." Seeing that this woman was not going to be easily dissuaded, Rabbi Orlovsky moved on. "Okay, do you have any special talents?" "No, not really." "Any special training?" "No." "Any profession?" "No." "Okay, what do you do well?" "Well, Rabbi, I bake fantastic cupcakes." "That's nice, but..." Rabbi Lasky was a little bit perplexed here. "I'm not really sure how you change the world with cupcakes." So doing what any good rabbi would do in the situation, he bought some time. Said, "You know what, let me think about it. Come back tomorrow, please." So she agreed and went home. The following day she came back to see Rabbi Orlovsky, and she said, "Don't worry about it, Rabbi, I figured it out myself." "Okay," asked Rabbi Orlovsky, "what are you going to do?" She said, "Well, there happens to be not too far from my house that there's a school for children with special needs. I'm going to bake a batch of my great cupcakes on Rosh Chodesh, the first of the month. I'm going to bring it over to these kids and give them some cupcakes." "Great," Rabbi Orlovsky said. "Gave her bracha, should have a lot of success." And so she did. She baked cupcakes, she brought them over to the school and distributed them. That night she received a call from the principal of the school. He explained to her that the children in that school suffered from many, many physical challenges. He said the one sense which works for all of them is the sense of taste. He said, "You have no idea the joy that you brought to those children by bringing them cupcakes." Inspired by this, obviously, she continued once a month to bring cupcakes to the school. A few months later, Rabbi Orlovsky bumped into her on the street. "How you doing? How's your project going?" "Great," she said. "I'm working on building a website." Not being a technical wizard, Rabbi Orlovsky was a little bit perplexed. Exactly what role does a website play in baking cupcakes? She explained, "After a few months of baking cupcakes, other schools heard about what I was doing, with other schools with similar children. They called me and asked, 'Can you bake cupcakes for our kids also?' I obviously couldn't bake cupcakes for all the schools, but I have friends and neighbors. So I started to ask my friends, I started to ask my neighbors. This one she agreed to bake once a week, this one she agreed to bake once a month, this one agreed to bake once every 3 months. After so many months, we have so many schools and so many women that we need a website to coordinate everything." I think this story kind of sells itself. The point is, though, that this mother so beautifully demonstrated these ideas that we've been talking about tonight. She was not satisfied to wait for the opportunities to make a difference, to present themselves to her. She looked for her talents, however they may not have been so obvious to anybody around her, and she looked for the opportunities to take those talents, which seemed rather ordinary, and to really do something extraordinary. Each of us has this same ability. As we approach Rosh Hashanah and we seek those answers and those arguments for why we deserve those blessings that we're asking for, let us commit ourselves to this approach, to saying, I'm looking for those blessings because I'm looking to use those blessings as a springboard to create for myself a lifestyle of kindness. Not only will I impact those around me, but it will be a truly wonderful feeling and experience for myself. In the merit of this commitment, may we all be blessed for a year filled with peace, health, and spiritual growth. And may we merit to join together again at this time next year to look back on the year that we've just completed and to say, yes, I have created and I have lived a lifestyle of kindness.